today we have Ann Sullivan, who's going to entertain us and edify us with a book report. She is a longtime teacher, longtime South Mainer, and I know that you know her, and she has done a number of book reports for us. They're always so lovely, and we're looking forward to this one about a book called An Education. Is that right? And The Educated. Okay, well, we'll bring her up. I've seen this book at the bookstore several times and thought about picking it up, and I go, oh, no, Ann's going to do this. I'll learn all about it already, and then I'll pick it up, I'm sure, too. So, Ann, thank you for being here today, and you go as long as you want, and then if we have a little bit extra time, I may ask you some questions about it after that. But we'll turn it over to you, and again, thanks for being here, everybody.
Okay. I want first to thank mainstreamers for letting me come back. You all flatter me not only by asking me to come, but by being here. I think some of you have heard each of the book talks and that you keep coming back. Wow. The book that I want to share with you is Educated, a memoir, and it's written by Tara Westover. In this book, she tells her life story of going from a kid who worked in the family's junkyard, never having a real school experience before college, and earning a PhD from Cambridge. The book debuted on the New York Times bestseller list the week that it was published. That's 77 weeks ago. The only time it's not been number one was just after Michelle Obama's Becoming was printed and just after the Mueller report. Educated was knocked off for a couple of weeks, but it is still there. It's number one Houston best-selling fiction, and it's number one Wall Street Journal best-selling fiction. And nonfiction. Excuse me, nonfiction. I read fiction. I talk to you about nonfiction. It was a 2018 book of the year. In 1986, Tara was born in southern Idaho to a family of isolationist and also survivalist. Her parents stockpiled food, weapons, ammunition, because they wanted to be ready if the feds ever came for them. And they also wanted to be ready because they expected the worst from Y2K. The family had a feeling of disdain, and some of them still do, disdain for anything in the medical profession, hospitals, public schools, and the government. They disliked medical professionals so much that even when they seriously needed help, as in when Mr. Westover was burned in his junkyard wearing a welder's mask that melted and his face and fingers were burned beyond description, they did not take him to the hospital. They used Mrs. Westover's herbs, ointments, and oils to heal him. Now, the parents would tell you that their children were homeschooled. And if you've ever seen homeschool kids shopping in HEB when you're there in the morning, you sometimes wonder about homeschooling. You would have really wondered about the Westovers' homeschooling, because the only time they were homeschooled was when the mother wasn't busy. And she'd say, we're going to have school today. Here are the textbooks. And she had a stack of textbooks. The kids would pick up a book, look at it. Tara remembers picking up a math book, covering 50 pages in 10 minutes, and telling her mother she'd done her math. And her mother said, oh, you could never move at that pace if you went to public school. Now, teenage son Tyler broke the family tradition, and he wanted to go to college. He wanted to go to BYU. His father sat him down before he went and said to him, son, The only people who go to college are the ones who were not smart enough to get it the first time around. He went anyway. After he left, Tara began thinking, maybe I'd like to go to college. So she started seriously looking at the textbooks that the family had collected. She read the Old Testament, she read the New Testament, she read the Book of Mormon, and she told her family that she wanted to go to BYU. Her dad always had an answer for everything, and he said, "Don't sell your birthright. Remember Cain and Abel? You don't sell your birthright and go to college." Jacob and Esau. Don't sell your birthright and go to college. Okay, so she kept studying. Her mother gave her a little encouragement, but she knew that she was going to have to make a 27 on the ACT. She studied, and she made a 22. This girl was determined. She studied again, and she made a 28, and she was accepted. She and her brother Tyler completed her application, sent it off, and almost immediately she received a letter that began, "Congratulations." Now, her living arrangement, her first year at BYU, was not two girls to a room, but it was four girls in a suite sort of situation. She gets to the suite, and she sees that the girls are wearing skirts above their knees, and they're drinking Coca-Colas. And she begins to wonder, are these girls real Mormons? And then she thought about her family, and she came to the conclusion that perhaps her family was the only truly Mormon family that she knew. Now, here she is as a freshman in college, having never taken a high school course. And so the vocabulary of her professors was a bit of a problem for her. In an art class, a professor used a word that she didn't know. She raised her hand, he called on her, she asked a question, and it was a question he refused to answer because he thought she was causing trouble. And all of the other kids she thought were looking at her thinking she's a freak, and she said, "I know that I am a freak, but how do they know so quickly?" She left after class and went immediately to the computer lab and looked up the word. The word was Holocaust. She wondered how anything so impactful could have been unknown to her. She went home that summer knowing she needed to make more money than usual. She applied for a job at the grocery store where she had worked before. She was hired. Second day home, she was going to go to work. But her parents had said to her, "You can't work there. Your responsibility is with the family. You must work in the junkyard." In fact, her mother said, "If you can't help your dad, you can't live here." And so, because she had accepted the job, she went to the grocery store, worked a 10-hour shift, resigned, came home, and headed to the junkyard. And she wrote in her book, "The sounds of the university were blocked in my brain by the clatter of iron and the roar of diesel engines." The only bright spot that summer was that she met a boy whom she calls Charles. It was not his real name, and she used pseudonyms for all of her siblings. But if you go online and look up the Westovers, you'll find their names, and you'll find out about the family business. So she and Charles dated that summer, and every time he would come to her house to take her on a date, she would be outside waiting for him because she didn't want him to meet her family. At the end of the summer, he picks her up, and he can tell she doesn't feel well. He asks her what's the matter, and she indicated that she had an earache. And he said, "Well, what have you taken for it?" And she named the herbs that her mother had given her. They went straight to his house. He went to the medicine cabinet, got out two pills, the first pills she had ever seen, convinced her to take them. She took them, and in 20 minutes, her earache was gone. During that first summer home from college, she began a real growth period in her life. She began to analyze her family and to analyze herself and to create her own principles for living, not her family's principles for living. And so she went back to BYU for her second semester. The same type living arrangement. This time the girls' shorts were too short, and they were still drinking Coca-Colas. But she got along better with them the second time around than she did her first roommates, because she really wasn't clean. She didn't keep her share of stuff in the kitchen sanitary. It was pretty bad, and she learned from her mistake. So she starts off the second semester on a better foot. But she's taking a math class, and she's working as a custodian. And it was just heavy duty since she'd, again, never had a math class. Made a low grade on the first test, went to the teacher, professor, and said, "What can I do?" He said, "Change courses. Get another professor. Drop the class. Just drop out of college and come back later when you're older." Tara was determined. She stuck with that professor. And he said some magic words during the semester. "If anyone makes 100 on the final, you're guaranteed an A." And you know what my next sentence is going to be. She made 100, and she made the A. During the spring semester, it was as if the fates had it in for her. She awakened one morning with a really sore jaw. She went to the dentist, and the dentist said, "I have to do a root canal, and you have to pay $1,400. What to do?" So she met with a bishop, and he said, "You can apply for a grant. Westovers don't take handouts. What to do?" There seemed to be nothing else. And so she got her parents' income tax form for the previous year and applied for the grant. And she got it. But instead of getting the $1,400 that she had asked for, she got $4,000. She called the number. In case of problems, call this number. She called it. And she said, "You've sent me too much money. I just asked for $1,400. And the lady on the other end said, "Look, honey, you get that much because that's how much you get." Tara had to decide what to do. Smart girl. She got the root canal. She bought a new Sunday dress. She put the rest of the money in the bank. And that money seemed to make such a difference in her life, because when she wasn't worried about money, it was as if she were seeing her professors in a new light through a clear lens. She was reading her textbooks, and as far as extra reading, she read more than was assigned. And she learned something very important in a class that semester. The professor in psychology mentioned bipolar disorder. As he was giving the description of the disorder, she's writing in her notes, "He's describing my father." During her junior year, the world began to seem very big for Tara. She took history. She took courses in politics. She took geography. But taking these courses caused a crisis for her. She went to Brigham Young as a music major, and she planned to take a lot of art courses. And these, in her view of what a Mormon woman should be, these courses didn't fit. Again, she talked to her professor, and he said, "Have you considered stretching yourself, growing a little bit?" He told her about a summer program at Cambridge. She didn't know where Cambridge is. And she applied. She never thought she was smart enough, so she doesn't think she got in because of herself. She thinks that it was her professor's recommendation. But she was accepted for a summer abroad at Cambridge. When she got there, she couldn't get over the beauty. She knew that she could not have dreamed anything so wonderful. The professor under whom she was to work was Professor Jonathan Steinberg. He had been teaching at Cambridge for 30 years. They began reading about historians, what she wanted to read for the summer. She began writing, and he began an all-out effort to teach her to be an outstanding writer. She turned in her first major paper. They set up a conference. Again, she's expecting the worst. And he said to her, "This is one of the best papers I've received in 30 years of teaching. You must go to graduate school." First thought, money. He said, "You should go to Harvard or Cambridge." "I can't go. I can't pay." And his answer was, "You get accepted. I'll worry about the fees." So she headed back to Brigham Young for her senior year. She saw that her family had added a new room to the house. Where did the money come from? The mother had become an online superstar selling herbs, oils, concoctions. And if you go online, you could order some from her. Tara went back to Cambridge to begin graduate study. Her family didn't change while she was away. In fact, one of her sisters had the courage to confront the father about how one brother, Sean, had treated them. The parents knew what Sean was like. At Thanksgiving, her freshman year, when she was at home, she was helping her mother in the kitchen. She was nervous the first time that Charles had ever been to her home. And he's sitting by Sean, and he's talking to her about all the guns he owns and about all the ways he knows to kill a person. And she dropped a plate, and Charles shouted at her, "You must apologize." Then he ran toward her, grabbed her, threw her on the floor, dragged her to the bathroom, and put her head in the toilet. Her parents and her siblings all saw it. So, fast forward again to where we were her senior year. Her sister decides to confront the parents. The father didn't believe it. And so Tara and her mother communicated, and the mother said words that Tara had waited for all of her life. "You were a child, and I should have protected you." Tara said that after her mother spoke those words, it was as if her mother had gained strength, and she, Tara, had gained strength. She saw the world more different. It was more different than it had seemed before. And she wasn't ashamed of having worked in the junkyard. And she wasn't ashamed of not having been to school before. And she said she became popular for dinner engagements. And I can understand why. When she told her stories, who in England would have believed these stories? The next time she was back in Idaho, she could tell that things had not changed. Sean used horrible words to describe his wife. I wouldn't say them. They're in the book. And he said he had put a bullet through her head, but it would be a waste of a good bullet. At that point, Tara decided. Audrey had tried convincing the parents. Now it's her turn. And so she spoke to her parents about Sean. And they didn't believe her. The father, in fact, called Sean, who lived nearby, and he came over. And when he came, he brought a knife with him that was coated in blood. He denied everything that she repeated. And no support for her. She left the next morning, and as she left her community, in front of Sean's house, she saw a dead dog with lots of blood. And the mother indicated that after Sean left the family, he killed the dog. Tara tried to forget that night. She had written in her journal every day for 15 years, but she couldn't do it. She said, writing in a journal is contemplative, and I couldn't think about anything. When she went back to England, she seemed to be in shock. Sean called her, and he said, I don't know whether to come to England and kill you myself or to hire an assassin. I think I'll hire an assassin because then I wouldn't have to buy an airplane ticket. When she called home, her mother and father were both on the phone. And the father said, I didn't hear Sean say those words to you. Therefore, I won't believe them. She went into deeper depression. That summer, she had an opportunity to go to Paris to study. And she got word that she was being offered a fellowship at Harvard. But she couldn't be excited about it. She went to Harvard again. Very, very difficult times because of her mental state. Her parents came to see her. They wouldn't stay in a motel or a hotel. The three, mother, father, and Tara, stayed in her dorm room. She heard her parents talking, and so she wasn't surprised when her father spoke to her and said that they had made the trip for him to give her a special blessing. This was a blessing that would drive out a demon. Tara said to her dad, I love you, Dad, but no. The parents left immediately. She went back to England. Still very, very depressed. Mental breakdown. Her advisor for the PhD program urged her to just drop out. Not determined, Tara, she started going for counseling. And she said there was not one session with the counselor that helped her get better. But the cumulative effect of all of the sessions with the counselor turned her life around. She went back to work on her dissertation and even included in it a non-biased evaluation of the history of Mormons in the concept was the history of the world and how Mormonism fitted into it. And so, 10 years after she entered BYU, Tara received her PhD from Cambridge. Several months later, she went home. Girls and moms, special relationship. She wanted to see her mom, and her mom refused to see her without her dad. Tara is still close to the three brothers in the family who went to college. But at the time she wrote the book, she was estranged from the rest of the family. Tara doesn't know if the issues with her family will ever end, but she is at peace. She knows that she made good decisions, and she accepts them. And she realizes now that the fractured person who was inside of her for so long, she's gotten rid of that fractured person by her own decisions. And once that happened, she knew at last that she was educated.
Anne, thank you. This is great. I've got some questions. Can I ask some questions?
Yes, because everyone knows I haven't prepared.
No, you haven't prepared. Okay, well, I kind of wanted to ask you about that. How do you prepare for something like this? Because you're just. I don't know how you do it. You keep eye contact so beautifully, and it's a presentation that includes so much content. How do you begin to prepare something like this?
Doug would tell you it doesn't happen overnight. I read the book early. I mean, long before I knew I was going to do this. So once Greg asked me, I read the book again. And I, after reading the chapter, wrote the highlights of the chapter. Now, this was, by the time I finished the book, I had about 30 pages of size 12 font. And so then I narrowed. Because I've done these before, I know how many pages I can have with size 12 font to be ready. And so I just kept cutting it. And then after I cut it, I suppose in June, I started reading it every day. And then I reached the point where I'm saying it to myself every day. And then by now, I was ready.
That's amazing. Because I was going to ask you, do you have memory devices? But it sounds like you've prepared it so much that it's in your mind and it just comes out that way. That's
really
amazing.
Well, it is in my mind, and it's a part of many conversations because it's such an interesting story.
Yeah.
It's so different from anything I experienced and that the people who are my friends have experienced.
And how do you explain the phenomenon of the book? If it's been on the best-selling list for 77 weeks, is it just this idea of worlds colliding that is so compelling to us? Or how would you explain the phenomenon of it?
I think, number one, she is a good writer. Because there are better books, nonfiction books than this. But it's the story. It's so unbelievable to a person who would buy a book at Barnes & Noble or order it from Amazon. It's just foreign to us.
And I think we got a sense of this, but what is sort of the tone of her book with respect to her family? It seems like she has respect for her family, but she's also sort of enlightened that she knows a little bit what's going on now. Is she humble about it, or does she say, I wish I could bring them out further, or what is the tone and emotion to it?
I wish that I had seen the interview, because Lee told me that she was interviewed on 60 Minutes, I'm thinking, and so from that interview and from what I know from what I know about the interview and what I know about the book is that she is able to function as life is. She accepts it. Her father and her mother and her siblings, most of her siblings, hurt her very badly. And I'm not sure, had she not gone to counseling, that she could have ever gotten her PhD, ever written the book.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting the way that you put about the counseling, that it wasn't like one session gave her a breakthrough, but it was cumulative. And I think that's an interesting way to approach counseling or therapy, that you just have to be patient with it sometimes.
And she was. Yeah. She had a goal, and she was goal-oriented, and if going to the counselor every week helped her reach her goal, that's a small price to pay. And it was probably free. It was part of the fees at Cambridge.
Talk a little bit about your own teaching experience when you saw maybe a student who maybe was behind because of their family circumstances or maybe weren't receiving family support. How did you treat them differently, or how did you approach a student like that?
First, I want to tell you about my current students. This is my ninth school year to be retired, 50 years in public education. And this is my ninth year to teach an ESL class through the Barbara Bush Library. I wanted to be a part of SMILE for 40 years, and by the time I retired, the traffic is too heavy. You don't see the Sullivans at South Main a lot because we live 45 minutes away nowadays. As I've worked in very small situations with the ladies in my English class, I probably have been more compassionate with them than I was back when you could have 35 kids in a room. And so I know them individually, and I know their needs. I'm going to start with a new student tomorrow who's not going to be ready for my class, but because she works on my street in a person's home, a family's home, she and I are buds. And so I'm thinking, what can I do to keep her from feeling behind? In a public school classroom, if kids are leveled, there's always somebody lower than you would expect. And so it's very, very hard in public school. But I always would try to give positive affirmations, get excited over anything that they did well, and let them know that I cared and that there's life beyond the classroom.
And how about interacting with their family? Is that something you could feel like comfortable doing? Or
I did some, but I will tell you, not a lot, because there were just so many people when you were teaching. I interacted more when I was a high school assistant principal. I remember one girl in particular who was probably my number one customer for a couple of years. And every time I would call home, her mother would swear, she would scream, she would cry. And I would try to build up her daughter. And so it was as if I had become the mother's counselor while I was the daughter's disciplinarian. I had a really funny experience. I was teaching a class of gifted kids, and I thought gifted kids should be able to write a simple term paper. And there was one mother who thought, "Oh no, you are asking too much, Mrs. Sullivan." And she was the only mother who called the principal about me during the 4 years I was at that school. I happened to be grocery shopping one day, and this mother saw me, and she came over and apologized. She met with me before she met with the principal. She apologized and said, "Mrs. Sullivan, our daughter at A&M, went to A&M, and one of her professors asked her where did she learn to write. And she told her she learned to write when she was in the seventh grade." And so the mother said, "Mrs. Sullivan, I owe you an apology." I always tried to build up the girl. I tried to build up the mother. You know, you sing "Share His Love." Well, you just find ways to share it.
Yeah. And in terms of connecting with a particular student, especially trying to, I guess, inculcate a love of reading or an ability to write, do you find out a little bit about what the kid's like, and do you recommend a particular book, or how do you kind of steer kids toward things that they might like, but also learn from the things that they need to learn?
Well, school librarians can be one's best friend. I don't read everything that's like this. I just finished one of my book clubs just finished discussing the Little Paris Bookshop, and in the Little Paris Bookshop, the owner knows his clients, his customers. It's not like going to Barnes & Noble, you know, happy to get help. But he really knows the people who come in his shop, and he tries to recommend books for them that would help them with things that are going on in their lives. And this must be a hot topic right now, because in the last couple of weeks, there's been an article about a bookshop in Philadelphia where the owner tries to do this, an op-ed piece in the New York Times about books helping, and then a book review of a new book about books as being able to give you help. And so I depended on librarians, but then as the year went on and I knew what kids liked, I'd help them pick out books. And with my ladies, because they are not reading on an adult level, my librarian friend and I look for books that can be interesting to adults but not insulting because they are kiddie-type stories.
Could you point us toward maybe three or four books that, you know me, I've had this experience at Specs. The person knows what kind of wine I might like, but I need some help probably for books. What if you wanted to point us toward three or four books that you've read over the last year or two that you think are particularly wonderful, that we shouldn't miss?
Ladies, a fun book, but a hard book to read, is Where the Crawdads Sing. We are going to Waco in October to hear a lecture series that we hear authors and like to go hear them there. And so one of the authors this year is Colum McCann, and I'm reading Let the Great World Spin. And I would recommend it for his writing. Just fabulous writing. If you were to come to my house, there are books everywhere. What else have I liked? What have I liked, Lee? What have I liked, Doug? What? Oh.
Yeah, there's always some misfires to it. You buy books and you start and they're not quite as good as you thought.
One that I just can't get through. It's about the Indians in Oklahoma.
The
Flower Moon. Yeah, I couldn't get through it.
Well, talk to us a little bit about like this young woman, Tara. It seems like she changed her mind, or she was open to new experiences so many times. Like, if you've been taught, you know, that medicine is bad and that, or this is an example, and then someone says, hey, you need to take this, how did she kind of begin to open herself up to more, maybe possibly a little bit more enlightened thinking?
I think it was because her friend, whom she trusted, offered her the pills. But she, growing up, knew that after horrible wrecks, that the family should have used the hospital, and that the family should have used the hospital for the father's burns. She wasn't blind to reality, but she couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah. The other thing I was struck by as you spoke was how much, I guess, power we have over the direction of our lives by our choices. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Maybe even turn it into your own life, about the choices that you've made in your life that you feel good about that have brought you to where you are right now. I know you just had a birthday too, right?
Absolutely.
But talk to us a little bit about the power of choice and the choices that you've made in your life.
Well, I'll go back to high school. Back in the dark ages, girls belonged to GAs and then YWAs. And the Garner girls were always at church every time the doors were open. And so on this particular evening, there was only one person at YWA. I was that person. And so the program that day was to be about the value of choosing a Baptist college. And there was a beautiful, beautiful girl in our church that I just would look at and think, oh, I want to be like her when I'm in high school and when I'm in college. And she spoke that day, and since it was just the two of us, she decided she would just talk to me about Baylor. And I decided then and there that I was going to come to Baylor. I wasn't considered quite the freak that Tara was, but I wasn't just considered the hottest chick around, you know. I went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday, anytime the doors were open. There were things that went on that girls in my family weren't supposed to do. So the decision to go to Baylor was really big. The next really big decision was I wanted to be a Baylor summer missionary, and I lost out to the girl who was going with the president of the BSU. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me because I applied to work for the Home Mission Board, and they sent me to the end of the cow trail, Sedalia, Missouri. I almost did not accept it. It just so happened that there was a young lieutenant whose father had been critically ill in the spring, and before his father passed away, the Air Force let this young lieutenant come to an air base just outside of Sedalia, Missouri. And so the first time I went to Training Union was the first time he had ever been to that church, and I can still see him walking in the door. Home Mission Board summer missionaries were not supposed to date, but in Missouri, they were allowed to date, and so Doug and I dated that summer. My next big decision was to teach school or getting a job and then getting married and doing a family, and I was just going to teach 2 years, 2 or 3 years. After 36 years of teaching, I was offered a job that I couldn't refuse. Well, it was teaching and central office, but I was offered in my retirement the job as district writer. The superintendent knew that I had written for the Sunday School Board for years before they let go anyone who belonged to a Baptist Fellowship Church. And so the superintendent wanted me to write for the district. And so that job meant that I could work for 50 years. So big decisions, but the little ones count too.
Thank you so much for being with us and just a great presentation. And feel like I've read the book now, but I'm going to pick it up. And just your presentation is just lovely. Let's give Ann a hand.